KPBS On Demand is supported by La Jolla Playhouse, premiering 3 summers of Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass met just 3 times to unite a divided nation. This spectacular new musical features an epic original score blending gospel, R&B, and Broadway. Begins February 18th. Tickets at LaJollaPlayhouse.org.
This is KPBS Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. Today, the latest on the wildfires that continue to burn across LA County and what it's been like to cover them. Then, a suite of new laws for California kicked in with the start of the new year. We check in on some of those. Plus, the latest on a fight for control of the San Diego Padres. The KPBS Roundtable starts now. As the Los Angeles fires continue to burn today, at least 180,000 are under evacuation orders, and at least 10 people have lost their lives. Thousands of homes and businesses are destroyed, leaving entire communities devastated. As of Friday morning, strong winds have somewhat calmed down, giving firefighters a chance to tackle the flames. A lot goes into getting the news out quickly and safely during a crisis like this. Ryan Mena has been on the front lines in Los Angeles throughout the week. She covers crime and public safety for the Southern California News Group. Ryan, welcome to Roundtable.
Thanks for having me.
So first off, thanks for joining us during what I imagine is a pretty unprecedented week in Los Angeles. Can you first, give us the latest? How many fires are we watching at this point?
Well, we're watching 4 major active fires, being the Kenneth, the Palisades, Hearst, and Eaton. There's also the Creek and Lydia and Sunset fires. Those have calmed down. The Sunset fire is inactive. But yeah, those are the 4 main ones we're watching.
And the Kenneth fire you mentioned, I think that's the kind of one of the more recent ones. What's the status of that? Do we know?
Yeah. So as of this morning, the Kenneth fire has burned about 1,000 acres. It is currently at 35% containment, and all evacuation orders and warnings were lifted as of 8 p.m. yesterday evening.
Now, I'm wondering if you can kind of walk us through the week you've had. I think the Pacific Palisades fire, that was the first to get started on Tuesday morning. How did you first hear about the fires this week?
So on Tuesday, it was kind of a normal Tuesday. It began a normal Tuesday work day. And then my editor called me and he was like, "We need you to go to the Palisades. There's a fire. We need you to cover it." And I was like, "All right, I am packing up my car with my fire gear, preparing myself, and I'm on my way." It took me about 2 hours to get down to Will Rogers State Beach. There was incredibly gridlocked traffic. People were evacuating. Sunset was completely gridlocked. And that's how my week began.
And so that first day you were covering the Palisades fire, when did you notice it becoming more than the average wildfire?
After my editor called me and told me about it, I turned on the radio and was getting updates on it. And I mean, it started as a vegetation fire and exploded into, what is now almost 20,000, about 20,000 acres. And I realized that this is not, when I got down there is when I realized that this is not normal. And just the amount of smoke that was coming off of the mountains, the amount of people that I saw evacuating, it was like nothing I've ever seen before.
Can you help us understand the magnitude of destruction this disaster has had in and around LA?
I mean, that's all everyone's talking about. People are wearing masks. People who aren't super close to the fires are evacuating. I myself left my home in Los Feliz a couple nights ago, the night of the Sunset fire, just in case the fire were to come closer in the Santa Monica Mountains our way. So everyone is just on high alert.
And, tragically, these fires, they seem to be more, more than just toppling buildings and homes, but have just ravaged entire communities. How has that shaped your approach to reporting on this story?
It shaped my approach in reporting on the story because, tens, hundreds of thousands of people are affected by this. And going down to Altadena on Wednesday is the closest I got to the fires and the devastation. And it looked like an apocalyptic war zone out there in Altadena, just blocks and blocks of houses just burned down to the ground. In some cases, just chimneys left, just the foundations left, charred skeletons of cars left over. It's devastating.
And you've spoken with people directly impacted by the fires. What mm-hmm. stories stand out for you?
Well, there's this one couple I spoke to in Altadena on Christmas Tree Lane. I met them as they were frantically packing up their cars. They were trying to figure out how to pack everything into their SUV. Well, just across the street, their house was burning down to the ground and a firefighter was trying to put out the flames, but they were just trying to get out as quickly as possible. Safety was, of course, first and foremost to them, as it is to so many others.
And I mean, you're from LA. You were born, you grew up there. How does that impact your approach to, you know, telling these stories, to speaking with these people, like you said, that may be losing their homes?
I mean, yeah, it makes it more personal, you know? I mean, I went to school on the west side of Los Angeles. I spent a lot of time in the Palisades as a youth, and seeing so many friends and people that I know's houses burned down to the ground, it's a lot to process, and it makes it more important to me to really get those human stories, to understand how people are feeling, how they're impacted, and what's going on in their minds. It puts a human element first and foremost.
How do you balance your emotions with your job to report the news? I mean, you just mentioned you have friends impacted by this, maybe family.
Yeah, it's really tough, honestly, especially going down to Altadena, getting right in front of the blazes. I had to take a moment and take a beat to kind of just feel what I was feeling, the overwhelmness of emotions flooding through me. But I knew I had a job to do. So although I did have those emotions, I had to put them on the back burner to deal with later and just report on the facts.
Can you describe what the fire looked and felt like to you?
Yeah. So in Altadena, when I first got to Christmas Tree Lane, there were a few houses that were on fire. And in those 15 minutes I spent first on that street, the flames grew significantly, which, you know, had me on high alert that, like, I might need to jump in my car and go. And as I was driving through another part of Altadena, I saw a bunch more charred cars and dilapidated buildings burned down to the ground. And I, for a moment there, I wasn't sure if I should turn around, if I should keep going, what I should do. But I reminded myself that, you know, my safety comes first and foremost, and, you know, I can't report if I'm not keeping safe.
And can you talk a little bit more about that? I mean, yes, you're trying to get information out there. You want to get as close to the story as possible, but these are obviously very dangerous conditions. How do you and your colleagues kind of approach that, the balance of staying safe, but also telling the stories of what's happening in these communities?
A balance, and journalists covering wildfires need to know when it's time to go. For example, on Tuesday, when I was covering the Palisades fire at Will Rogers State Beach, the fire was about half a mile from us, and there came a point when embers started hitting close to my feet. That's when I knew I needed to go. And in Altadena on Wednesday, I was driving around and I was getting pretty close to really open flames. And I had to do a gut check with myself, and I didn't feel safe. So I went a different way. And I think all journalists need to be in touch with their cut to know when it's time to go. Because yes, we need to get in the thick of it, get close to the devastation that's going on. But at the same time, we need to keep ourselves safe. And that comes first.
What are you seeing from people, you know, in these communities that have been impacted? Obviously, Altadena and Pacific Palisades are these, you know, are the main neighborhoods here that have just been devastated. What are people doing to support their community members and neighbors? What have you seen there in the last couple of days?
Yeah, so it's brought out a lot of good in people, I think. I think about this time in Altadena on Wednesday, there was this car trapped underneath this tree, and a bunch of neighbors came around to help this man get his car from out under the tree. And that put a big smile on my face, just seeing how, despite the devastation and all the tragedies going on around us, people are still putting themselves at risk to help one another out.
Ryan Mena covers crime and public safety for the Southern California News Group. Ryan, just want to say thank you so much for taking time to share some of your reporting with us from the week, and we hope you continue to stay safe.
Thank you.
When Roundtable returns, California state lawmakers are back in session in Sacramento. What will they be prioritizing for 2025?
Affordability is going to be a big issue this legislative session. The Democratic leadership have already come in saying, look, we see that we haven't done enough on affordability. We see that in the election results.
That's coming up on Roundtable.
KPBS On Demand is supported by the National Conflict Resolution Center. Geopolitics, a divisive election year, and strained budgets are all topics that can create tension in the workplace. NCRC can help workplace leaders navigate polarizing issues with the Culture, Communication, and Conflict Certificate. More at ncrconline.com.
Welcome back to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. California has around 1,000 new state laws now in effect with the start of the year. They tackle everything from what shows up on your credit report to new family leave protections for California workers. And with so many new laws, it can be difficult to figure out which ones matter the most. So here to break it down with us is CalMatters Capital reporter Jeannie Kwong. Jeannie, welcome back to Roundtable.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so, you know, a lot of new laws here. We're not going to get through all of them, but I want to start with the new increased penalties for, you know, certain nonviolent crimes. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah. So, you know, there's actually two whole packages related to this. One of them was on your ballot in the fall, Prop 36. That went into effect in December, actually. And that was the effort by prosecutors and some police and kind of big box retail stores that they had put it on the ballot to undo some of the criminal justice reforms of 2014 that voters had passed then. So now, you know, for certain nonviolent drug and theft offenses, you can be charged additionally for the third offense. And that's mostly to kind of address this rise in, you know, people's concerns about a rise in property crime and drug crimes, especially coming out of the pandemic. But, you know, before that, there was already a package of other laws having to do with retail theft that Newsom had signed over the summer, and they also went into effect in January. And so a lot of these seem kind of similar, but they're really just allowing for, you know, enhanced penalties for certain types of retail theft crimes. Some of them are just kind of making it easier for prosecutors to charge, you know, more serious crimes. One of the laws allows prosecutors to collect crimes across multiple counties so that they can kind of bundle them together in one court, charging them as a felony. Yeah, things like that. There was like a whole package of those that was passed over the summer.
There are also new rules for parking near a crosswalk, this daylighting law. How does that work and what's it meant to fix?
There's this issue with, you know, when you park too close to a crosswalk, it can pose a hazard to cyclists and pedestrians when you're too close to the corner. And so going into effect this year, you can no longer park within 20 feet of that crosswalk or of that corner. And police can start fining drivers for that or issuing citations. So that's definitely something to look out for this year.
So I want to turn now to some of these new laws addressing affordability across the state. One of them, it prevents medical debt from appearing on credit reports. That can be pretty huge for those struggling with medical bills. What will this mean for them?
So it just means that anyone who is collecting debt. Health providers or debt collectors who are collecting medical debt, they cannot report that information to credit agencies when, you know, when somebody gets a credit check done. It doesn't mean that the debt goes away or that it gets reduced in any way. It's just that that particular kind of unpaid bill doesn't show up on your credit report. So, you know, if you kind of if you had an emergency, you know, if you had to go to the ER, had to go to the hospital, and are still paying that off, that particular debt cannot no longer be reported to the credit agency.
Do we have any idea how many people this potentially could impact in California?
I do not know specifically, but during the analysis for this bill, during the legislative hearings, it was reported that nearly 40% of California residents carry some kind of medical debt. And so obviously that figure is also much larger for low-income residents. That's according to the California Healthcare Foundation.
And, you know, kind of on that, new laws that could impact lower-income Californians. Another new law protects people from overdraft fees from certain banks. Can you give us the details there?
It's AB 2017. It applies to banks and credit unions that are state regulated. This basically gets rid of what advocates call junk fees, which are the fees that they can charge you when you, you know, get a decline charge at an ATM because of insufficient funds. You know, they're so-called junk fees because you don't actually get anything for paying that fee. You know, you don't get the money. And, you know, some of these insufficient fund charges can be $30, even more, according to the advocates that pushed for the bill. So this year, these financial institutions are no longer allowed to charge them. And it's just part of a series of different laws that the state has passed in recent years, trying to limit the impact of, you know, not having enough funds, you know, trying to limit that impact on low-income people, on low-income residents.
So let's talk about new workplace protections. Minimum wage has gone up, but there's also a huge boost to paid family leave. Who'll benefit from that?
Yeah, the paid family leave program is paid for by workers. There's a slightly higher than 1% tax on people's incomes, and that goes towards the state's disability benefits program. So paid family leave is part of that. It's something that workers are eligible to take if they need to take time off for the birth of a new child, for taking care of family members who are sick. You know, if you need to take time off for things like that, you can kind of apply through the state and get part of your wages replaced for that time. It's, you know, sort of similar to unemployment, but for these specific reasons that you're taking time off from work. And in the past, lower income workers would get 70% of their wages replaced, while higher income workers would get, I think it was 60% of their wages replaced. That 70% was considered, you know, still very unaffordable for lower income workers. And so, you know, even though people are paying into the system with the tax off their wages, they oftentimes weren't able to take it because they just weren't able to afford that kind of cut in their wages. So starting this year, for lower income workers, it goes up to 90% of your wages get replaced if you're approved for the program, and 70% for higher income workers.
And then there's another labor law, and this prevents employers from making staff attend captive audience meetings. Can you break that down? What are captive audience meetings and how does this law work?
This one's pretty controversial. It was pushed by the state's unions. Captive audience meetings are a term to refer to essentially workplace meetings that you're required to attend by your boss. And they kind of sit you down and talk to you about their views on whether or not you should join a union. You know, obviously unions don't like this because it is oftentimes seen as a way for the employer to intimidate workers, talk them out of joining a union. And especially because you are required to go by your boss. So, you know, people can be subject to discipline or even firing for not going to one of these. So this has been allowed for a long time by federal law, although it is also kind of being disputed now with the Biden administration. But the the state law that went into effect in January says you can't require your workers to do this. You can't require them to go to a meeting where you talk about your political or religious views is what the law says. But that basically also includes whether or not workers should join a union. That's one of the topics of these meetings that employers cannot require their workers to attend. Now, this went into effect January 1st, but the state's business groups, the Chamber of Commerce and the Restaurant Association, they think this is considered a violation of employers' free speech rights. They say there are lots of legitimate reasons for an employer to need to talk to their workers about developments in politics or about unionization. So they have sued the state over it, alleging free speech violations, and they're trying to stop the law. So, you know, we'll have to stay tuned to see how far that goes.
You know, in the last year or two, I think California's labor movement, a lot of the unions, were quite successful in passing legislation at the state level. Is this another sort of demonstration of their increased power in Sacramento?
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's a Democratic supermajority state. Unions and the labor movement do command a lot of power in the Capitol. And they have for a long time. This, you know, in response to the lawsuit, they kind of say, like, you know, we saw this coming. Businesses have challenged this law in a number of other states, too, that have passed it in recent years. So it's part of a wave of, you know, Democratic states across the country trying to support this, you know, revitalized labor movement that we've seen the past few years. Specifically here in California, I think this was one of the laws that unions won this past year that really shows them trying to sort of strengthen the state's own labor laws in the face of an upcoming Trump administration. I mean, obviously it was passed before the election, but the kind of fortunes of unions and their ability to have major wins nationally change all the time with each presidential administration. They're expecting to have a much less favorable environment at the federal level soon. So this was one of the ways that they saw themselves as having secured a more union-friendly environment at the state level. And so I think, you know, the outcome of this lawsuit may, you know, we'll have to see whether or not they manage to sort of secure that kind of insurance against changes at the federal level here in the state.
So being the home of Silicon Valley, I think, you know, California is often on the sort of cutting edge of regulating new technology. I think in the last 2 years or so, really the focus has been AI. I mean, what new laws related to technology and specifically AI are we seeing?
Yeah, so there's a number of new laws trying to regulate AI, specifically the kind of like recreation of someone's image, you know, for business purposes or even for the purpose of spreading misinformation. So there's a new law having to do with requiring social media companies to moderate or label, you know, deep fakes, which are these kind of impersonations of public figures that is AI created, often spread in election related misinformation. There's another law that has to do with kind of helping actors, performers, singers, you know, not be required to sign away the rights to their image, you know, out of fear that, you know, a production company could recreate their image and then kind of use that rather than hiring or paying an actor or performer in the future. So these are ways that the state did manage to pass some laws regulating AI this past year. But it was a tough uphill battle to do that. And I definitely think that's something we're going to see return this coming legislative session, this current new legislative session. I definitely don't think lawmakers are done here. And yet, you know, the rise of big tech and their influence in the Capitol is something that we're still seeing, like just how much influence they have in being able to fight back some of these proposed regulations.
Now, zooming out a bit more, I mean, I think looking back on the election last November, it's hard to ignore that some of the deep political divides across our nation and across the state. And I'm curious, you know, how are you seeing that play out in legislation coming out of Sacramento, either last year or, you know, coming into 2025 now?
Yeah, you're going to be seeing a lot of Democrats kind of trying to reclaim their mantle as helping working people, helping people who can't afford to be in California, really afford to stay here, to live here. And you're going to see also Republicans, you know, constantly poking at the supermajority and trying to point out ways in which they see the Democrats as having failed at that mission. So I definitely think, you know, affordability is going to be a big issue this legislative session. The Democratic leadership have already come in saying, look, we see that we haven't done enough on affordability. We see that in the election results. And, you know, we're going to try to make it easier to build new houses. We're going to try to reduce gas prices, you know, do things like that. And that's going to be on their agenda. At the same time, you'll see Republicans who are saying we're the ones who are doing that. So they've already introduced a few bills, you know, trying to lower gas and electricity taxes. They're trying to exempt tipped service workers from having to pay income tax on their tips. That was a proposal that former President Trump had during the campaign trail, and then Vice President Harris had also copied. Like, these are all things that you're going to see recreated at the state level where, you know, Republicans, they don't have a lot of power having a super minority, yet they're kind of being emboldened by these election results from around the country. And they're going to be trying to use this moment to show that they're the ones whose policies actually benefit affordability for Californians. And then I think another thing we're going to see is just sort of return of the resistance state. Obviously, California was one of the major states kind of passing things, passing laws in opposition to the Trump administration the last time, filing lawsuits against the Trump administration over, you know, areas as wide ranging as healthcare and immigration. And we're going to see that happening again. The governor has called a special legislative session to ask for the state to allocate money towards lawsuits, essentially, like funding lawyers to fight the Trump administration. And that's something that the Republicans have really, really jumped on the Democrats for. And even now, in light of the fires and the upcoming crisis that homeowners face with insurance, they've already sort of taken the opportunity to criticize Democrats for even considering prioritizing fighting Trump, you know, over the kind of current situation as it relates to household budgets, essentially here at home in California. You know, not to say those things are mutually exclusive, but I think that's the kind of dynamic you're going to see, that it's going to be a lot of a battle over who gets to take credit over actually helping people's sort of personal household economic situations here.
As you mentioned, I mean, Trump is not even in office, and we're already seeing some war of words between Governor Newsom and Trump this week, you know, in the backdrop of the fires in Los Angeles, right?
Yeah, definitely. We're, you know, we're definitely no stranger to that. That happened a lot during the last Trump administration. So I think we're going to have to get ready for a lot more.
I've been speaking with Jeannie Kwong, Capitol reporter at Cal Matters. Jeannie, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, we hear about the latest on the fight to control the San Diego Padres and what it could mean for the team going forward.
What we do know is it raises many questions about what the potential impact on the team could be, and I think people care about that most. The long-term future, the person who's in control of that, they could steer that any number of directions. So it seems like a seminal moment, you know, for the Padres moving ahead.
Stay tuned. Roundtable's back after the break.
KPBS On Demand is supported by La Jolla Playhouse, premiering 3 summers of Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass met just 3 times to unite a divided nation. This spectacular new musical features an epic original score blending gospel, R&B, and Broadway. Begins February 18th. Tickets at LaJollaPlayhouse.org.
You're listening to KPBS Roundtable. I'm Andrew Bracken. The start of a new baseball season may seem far off, but opening day is just about 2 months away. It's what's happening off the baseball diamond that has Padre fans talking this week. On Monday, Sheil Seidler, the widow of former owner Peter Seidler, filed a complaint against her brothers-in-law in a fight for control of the team. It's a fight, she says, that's also over the legacy of the popular former owner. Bryce Miller joins me now to talk more about it. He's a sports columnist with the San Diego Union-Tribune. Bryce, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thank you. Glad to be here.
So tell us more about this complaint filed by Sheil Seidler, wife of late Padres owner Peter.
It's really about the position of control with the Padres. In fact, it's called control person, and that essentially means the point person, the top decision maker for each team in Major League Baseball. She's clearly, Sheil Seidler and her family have the biggest single stake in the Padres in terms of ownership. But this is a different role that makes determinations related to money, spending, free agents, any number, ballpark maintenance, kind of the final say on any number of things related to the baseball team. And what the dispute centers around is her sense, or her claim, I guess, is a fairer way to say it, that she was promised and would become that person at some point and be the bridge in terms of control of the team to her three children down the road when they're old enough to be involved. Peter Seidler had 9 siblings, and a couple of those siblings, Matt and Bob, are directly involved in the dispute about who Peter designated, who they claim in something called governing documents, that it was always outlined that Sheil Seidler wouldn't be the control person. Sheil Seidler disputes that. So now it's kind of a power struggle about control of that team into the future.
So kind of going back a bit, I mean, tell us more about Peter Seidler and the legacy he's left for the Padres.
It's unmatched, really, and I don't think it's hyperbolic to say it might be unmatched even outside of San Diego in terms of ownership of a baseball team. I knew Peter really well, did a lot of stories with him. In fact, some of the biggest things we did together in terms of stories was focused on his effort to help the homeless, something, you know, that he passionately believed in, invested in, brought together a grassroots collection of people with reach and influence in the community to try to do real things that made real impact. But he won the hearts of Padre fans by investing like never before, an unprecedented amount of money. You just have to look back at the contracts of Manny Machado. That's a player up until that moment. Almost everybody in baseball thought it would be impossible for the Padres to get a player like that, to pay a player like that. But Peter Seidler dreamed bigger. He invested more. The long-term deal for Fernando Tatis Jr., which at the time was, I think it was $340 million, and everybody's eyes popped out of their head at that number. But now looking at the numbers, Juan Soto getting $700 million plus potentially, Shohei Ohtani with the Dodgers getting $700 million. That number starts to look in the long term, potentially, if he can produce at the levels he has so far, like more of a bargain. But again, that's part of Peter Seidler's influence, the ability to spend and lock in key players like that. So the fan base appreciated because that wasn't the Padres' legacy of investing in players like that.
So it was this kind of financial commitment. Like,
sure.
He really kind of put that on display for the Padres in ways that previous owners hadn't. So who's been in charge of the team since Peter Seidler passed away in late 2023?
The current control person is somebody named Eric Katsenda, and he was one of the founding partners along with Peter in Seidler Equity Partners, I believe is the name of the equity firm. It's private equity. So he had a lot of business connections and experience and a relationship with Peter on a business level. And right now the team has said that they're trying to designate one of Seidler's living siblings, John Seidler, to be the control person. That's kind of in limbo right now because you need 3/4 of baseball's owners to vote and support that. And if they do, he will become that. There's an owners meeting next month. So the timetable is maybe a month from now. We know if the, you know, the control of the Padres is handed over to John Seidler. So it's in the middle of this transition that this suit in Texas lands, which kind of complicates the conversation even more.
So tell us more about Sheil Seidler. What has been her involvement in the team, you know, while Peter was alive and in control? And, you know, how does she argue that his legacy is now being damaged under the leadership of her brothers-in-law here?
Yeah, I know Sheil Seidler best of anybody, by far the best of anybody involved in the in this whole story. Last October, she had reached out and said she wanted to talk publicly about Peter's legacy, and she hadn't. It was an exclusive interview. It's to date her only extensive interview, and I went to their Coronado home, and we talked for, I don't know, an hour and a half. And the bulk of that conversation was about Peter and his legacy and his wishes and what he thought about the future, which we weren't privy to because he passed, you know, far too soon because of complications from a compromised immune system. But he was also a two-time cancer survivor. So she talked mostly about the legacy, but one piece of that in the interview, I know that when I asked the question about what is the plan moving ahead in terms of, you know, ownership, management of the Padres, and she said that Peter's plan was always, I would be the bridge to their three children, to her three children, taking over at some point when they're in position to do that. Now that's at the absolute center of the debate between the Seidler siblings and Sheil Seidler. But one, when you asked about her as a person, my take, knowing her just in the ways that I do, and again, I don't know the other brothers at all, a very kind, compassionate person as far as I can tell. There were a lot of not newspaper-related conversations that we had or text messages that kind of, you know, pulled back the curtain on somebody that was a people person and cared. And that's why this just feels awkward in ways that go beyond courtrooms to me a little bit. But again, I wasn't in those rooms. I wasn't in those conversations. I haven't seen those documents.
And in Sheil Seidler's statement on Monday, I think, that she announced the filing, she called this a last resort. I mean, so it sounds like this was a surprise to you from, you know, when you spoke to her last fall.
Well, yeah, at that point, probably, but not soon after, you know, we'd heard about a little simmering potential tension, not fully knowing what that meant. And so to a degree, I guess, a little bit of surprise, but not entirely. This had simmered for a while. I mean, that's what, if you've read through the 97-page document that was filed, this kind of back and forth has been months, if not more than a year. And so, you know, framing it in the way you mentioned as it was a last resort seems to signal that she thought this had to go public in her mind to kind of reset what she claims are the rights of her and her children. And again, the Seidler brothers have a different version of that, including something they call the governing documents, which I think in court we'll find out more about those.
Yeah, and kind of one thing that struck me about just reading her statement, I haven't read the whole 97-page report like I think you have, but right, is, you know, obviously there's the legal wrangling, the fight for control, but there's also just, I mean, I don't know how to say it any other way, but just hurt feelings and just, you know, real emotional disappointment and kind of, you know, kind of a common thing that I think a lot of families go through potentially.
Yeah, this is, you're right. A lot of families go through it. They don't generally go through it with a $2.5 billion Major
Sports
League Baseball team. But that's a rough estimate off the top of my head, but I think it's estimated to be somewhere in that at that level. Yeah, that's what makes it messy potentially. But what ramps that up and what I wrote about in the Union Tribune is what we do know is it raises many questions about what the potential impact on the team could be, and I think people care about that most.
Yeah.
The long-term future, the person who's in control of that, they could steer that any number of directions. So it seems like a seminal moment, you know, for the Padres moving ahead.
Well, let's dig into that, because one thing I'm curious about is, I mean, have you seen any change in the short-term outlook just since Peter's Peter's passing in the sense that earlier you had mentioned, you know, just the amount of money and investment and attention he paid to building the Padres up. We haven't had that much time, you know, with new leadership. Do you get a sense that leadership is kind of maintaining that focus and that commitment to the team?
Well, you can look back, you know, on paper, on the field, the Juan Soto trade, and that changed the pot. That was part of their shift to trying to get finances a little more under control. Seidler's spending, again, was unprecedented, but they were up against multiple penalties, consecutive seasons with the competitive balance tax, quote-unquote luxury tax. But they had to get under that number to reset the clock. Otherwise, you're just setting that money on fire. And they clearly are trying to be a more focused, efficient business moving ahead. Not that they weren't under Peter, but I think he had bolder vision and saw, you know, he saw parades and trophies and what it would mean to San Diego. Now the group that's collected seems to be more business oriented in the sense that they know there's a long-term picture here too. So that's part of it. But, you know, in the short term, I know Kevin Acey, my colleague, was at the GM meetings or winter meetings, I forget which one. And he's reported that he heard, you know, some of the maybe uncertainty about who's in control of the Padres might have limited what they've done this offseason. I could see it having that potential. I don't know that that's the case, but I know that question is out there. And to this point, they've really done nothing of substance this offseason. But A.J. Preller has made moves very late, even at spring training. I think they signed Machado around then initially. And so that's a potential ripple, but there's still time left before the season.
And what about more of the long-term impacts? I mean, you mentioned that could even be potentially having impacts this offseason. Right. What's at stake long-term for the Padres in this, you know, potential ongoing legal fight?
Well, I think what's at stake short-term in a baseball sense is also what's at stake long-term. Hypothetically, if free agents have options and they narrow it down to a couple of teams, if they see this as potentially too messy or they are uncertain what the future looks like with the franchise, could that be a tipping point in a decision for a key player the Padres need? There's no way to know that, but that's certainly a possibility. One of the biggest ones this offseason, we should know here shortly this month, is Roki Sasaki, the Japanese pitcher. Everybody in baseball wants him. He, without getting too deep in the weeds about Japanese posting and how that works, that players move from Japan to here, he decided to post early, which means he won't get the gigantic contract that, we've seen other Japanese players get. So he's very affordable and controllable at a younger age. And if he's as good as everyone says, you might lock up 6 years with Sasaki. Is he concerned about what he hears about the franchise and the uncertainty about ownership? All those things affect the long term as well as the short term.
What have you been hearing from Padre fans about this story?
I see a divide early on. I think there's some who support Sheil Seidler because she has signaled previously, and you know, I think they connect her with Peter in this sense, that she would be more of a trusted spender, investor, aggressive. So I think they see that potential with her. Others, I think, are lining up behind some of the Seidler brothers because of their extensive experience in business. Many of them have worked with Peter in that world. So it's unclear. I don't know what that divide looks like in terms of raw numbers, but you see two sides have formed in this dispute.
And I guess, you know, it seems like you're a little uneasy. You ended your column with the words, pass the antacids. I mean, yeah, where are you with this?
Well, I was trying to write at the beginning and ending of that column with kind of a fan's voice. Like,
yeah.
If I'm a fan, what am I thinking right now? And it's, I don't like it because it is so uncertain. And it is... It does have potential for negative outcomes. But Matt Seidler, who's in charge of the Seidler Trust, which really ultimately has decision-making power on the control person, as far as I understand it, he came out. We had it in the newspaper today. It's, and you can find it everywhere online now. He said in no uncertain terms, there's never been a discussion about relocation of this team or a sale. And so one of those concerns was addressed directly, I think. I think both sides agree on this. It's San Diego's team. But those are the kind of questions, until they come out publicly and discuss them, that really loomed over the city in terms of the Padres.
Well, like you said, they're kind of, like you said earlier, sort of this idea of uncertainty can kind of, you know, create confusion and just
Absolutely.
Fear in players and fans alike.
Yep.
Well, we appreciate you kind of breaking this down, and we'll kind of following the story and hope to have you back on. Bryce Miller is a sports columnist with the San Diego Union-Tribune. Bryce, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That'll do it for Roundtable this week. Thanks so much for listening. You can listen to KPBS Roundtable anytime as a podcast. Roundtable airs on KPBS FM at noon on Fridays, again Sundays at 6 a.m. If you have any thoughts on today's show, you can email us at roundtable@kpbs.org or leave us a message at 619-452-0228. Roundtable's technical producers this week were Brandon Trufa and Rebecca Chacone. The show was produced by Ashley Rush. Brooke Ruth is Roundtable's senior producer. I'm your host, Andrew Bracken. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.
KPBS On Demand is supported by the San Diego County Toyota Dealers. Experience the new 2024 Corolla with classic styling and offering up to 35 mpg, Toyota Safety Sense 3.0, and more. See your Toyota dealer to explore all Corolla options. San Diego County Toyota Dealers. We make it easy.